Hey, everybody, this is Stu Smith with another Tactical Fitness Report, and today we are welcoming Tyler Koch, who is a master's degreed exercise physiologist, a CSCS, and about to be a student at Penn State to become a physician's assistant. So you are very well trained, sir, and I just want to welcome you to my Tactical Fitness Report, because it's one of those things where we just try to talk, you know, throughout the tactical fitness world, because it's so vast and there's so many different, you know, elements to it that, you know, it really does require some understanding that tactical fitness is being good at everything, but not great at any one thing. Right. And what does that mean as a coach? You know, how do you coach that? Because it's a little bit different than being an athlete who needs to be really, really good or great at a few elements of fitness. And there are some things that they don't need to do. Let's start off with you and your journey to become a coach. What was your interest? Were you an athlete when you were young and just loved your coaches, wanted to be one? How did that journey go for you?
Yeah. So it's funny, upon self-reflection, you realize these little trends in your life. My dad was always my coach growing up, and I played baseball and soccer, and I was someone who matured a little bit later. So there was not a huge avenue for me as far as elite athleticism. But I graduated high school, went to college for undergrad, and I started training there. And my first real experience was I helped a friend of mine lose about 100 pounds. Over the course of a year. And, you know, a lot of it at that time, looking back, was just having healthy habits was really what helped him on that front. It was nothing special about the coaching. It was just eat well, show up to the gym, be consistent. Let's go for a walk after your meal, go for a walk before going to sleep at night, that type of thing. And then for me, what really was a catalyst is I actually got into CrossFit in my early 20s and just had an amazing increase in strength and capacity. And it was such an interesting experience to go through that personally, where you kind of have this body and then all of a sudden you have a new body that's much more capable than anything you've experienced before, which obviously I know you've gone through that at a much higher level than me. But I think having gone through that as a person is a really eye-opening experience, and it sort of shows you what's on the table for other people as well, that you have the opportunity to help other people go through that same process. So that was really the catalyst for me of getting into coaching. And then over time, I actually started my career helping start and run a CrossFit affiliate in Seattle, Washington. Did that for about 2.5 years and really got a sense for kind of coaching at scale, I would say, as opposed to being much more precise on an individual perspective. And love that. And again, the real benefit of a job like that is, you know, I had 50 or 60 people. We were a small affiliate, but you have 50 or 60 people that you get to spend time with almost on a daily basis, and you get to see them grow and you get to help them adapt to whatever it is they're working towards. And so that for me was the real catalyst to want to go to graduate school to learn this at a higher level, because it was very clear to me as I was coaching during that time that the people that I looked up to in the field, who I would kind of call my mentors, even though, you know, kind of like you, I listened to them on podcasts and I would read their articles, things like that. I didn't know them in person, but nonetheless, you get this wonderful knowledge sharing because of this medium. It was very clear that I was not at their level and that there was a gap between me and them. And they were working with fighter pilots. You know, they were working with SEALs. They were working in that area that I wanted to be in, or it could be, you know, elite sports for other people. And so graduate school was this great avenue for me to sort of learn and make sure that I understood actually what I was talking about and the complexity of the body and anatomy and sort of all these other important topics to know. And then from there, I was able to take that and, you know, kind of train athletes and then get into the tactical realm. And so just to bring everything back to the initial part of your question, I think for me, the interest in coaching has been something that's evolved over time, and my interests have changed over time. Initially, it was CrossFit, and I was like, I'm going to be a CrossFit athlete. And they got into athletes, and I worked with a professional MMA athlete. It's like, wow, I could do MMA. And then it was like, well, the military opened up. Well, I could do military. And now it's like, well, you know, now I can help coach people taking this knowledge of human performance and strength and conditioning and now apply it to, you know, orthopedic medicine. So it's definitely been an evolution over time for me as I've learned more and been around people who are incredibly intelligent and taught me a lot. It's been a really fun journey so far.
Nice. You know, it's funny. I always like hearing people's origin story. And mine as a coach and trainer was also helping someone lose 80 to 100 pounds. And I found that to be just so rewarding.
Yeah.
Because when you help somebody lose 100 pounds, you have changed their life.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, I've trained countless people, you know, to get 20 pull-ups and run a 6-minute mile and things like that, which is a lot of fun. That is, you know, I enjoy that as well, but there's nothing quite like the reward of changing someone's life. You know,
completely agree. And, yeah, like you said, it's so different than the classic avenues of strength and conditioning, which a lot of people think of. We're going to get you stronger. We're going to get you bigger. We're going to improve your pull-ups. Weight loss is a very different mindset for people. It's obviously a different goal that people have. So yeah, just incredibly rewarding. And, you know, that process is pretty long too. You can go with someone from 10 to 20 pull-ups if a young athlete pretty quick, but you cannot lose 80 to 100 pounds pretty quick. So you really get to invest time as a coach, which is something that's also really rewarding.
Yeah. You get to make those relationships too. And, you know, the return on relationships comes back tenfold when you help somebody lose 100 pounds.
I mean, completely agree.
They become your friends, they become your family, and next thing you know, you're invited to their wedding, and
yeah,
you know, it expands your world in ways that I don't think most people realize when they started an interest in becoming a fitness coach.
Completely. And I think that's probably one of the differentiators between, you know, someone who's telling someone what to do and someone who's a coach. Part of that is the knowledge base, but part of it's the investment too, you know, and that's something that I've found as I've, you know, worked in this field a while as well, but had that first initial experience. You're a coach, you're helping develop, you're helping adapt. And that's the real joy of, you know, being able to do this professionally, is you get to be a professional coach with the avenue of using the weight room as your toolkit, but it's just really rewarding because of that.
So if you would, you know, a lot of trainers like to watch this show, and let's just quickly go through some of your certifications, like the CSCS, if you don't mind.
Sure.
How did you like that? Did you get that before you were a master's student? Or was that part of the process of becoming a master's student?
Good question. Yeah, I think my first initial certification was through AFA, with American Fitness Aerobics, something along those lines. I don't remember exactly. But the CSCS, to your specific question, I got that when I was running the CrossFit affiliate in Seattle before I went to graduate school as sort of a prep for graduate school. And during that time, I got my USA level 1 as well, which was for Olympic weightlifting.
Nice.
So those are the two big ones I had going into graduate school, which was really helpful. And then graduate school, of course, getting your master's is amazing to go through that experience. And then I think after that, I've just kept up my CSCS.
Yep.
But as far as the knowledge base built from the CSCS, it was really impactful because it was the first time I'd ever taken a certification that really helped you understand specifically what you're trying to adapt athletes to. Because I think in our field, the single word that describes it is adaptation. That's really what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
In the CSCS, I thought was a really good primer and a really good introduction to say, like, you have bioenergetics. That's one type of adaptation. You have strength, which is, a nervous system adaptation. You have hypertrophy, which is a physiological adaptation. And it sort of helped you think bigger and more broadly along those lines. So that for me was a really eye-opening moment to go through that. And it took me about 6 months because I didn't really have a background in anything like that, just to study and prepare and take the test.
Same. Yeah. You know what? I tell people all the time, get the book and read it from cover to cover, answer all the questions, every chapter, take a couple practice tests, because I remember walking in there. And, you know, I don't have a master's degree in exercise physiology. And I remember walking in there and there were dudes with master's degrees that are taking it their second time because they failed it the first time. And I was like, what?
Not uncommon.
It's hard. I mean,
yeah, it is.
I was really proud of it. I think I did that almost 20 years now. Got the CSCS. And since then, the National Strength and Conditioning Association has really evolved, and they created a new tactical strength and conditioning certification as well. And the tactical fitness conferences that they have are really good. And you can meet just about everybody in the business.
Yeah.
You know, military, law enforcement, firefighters. I really enjoy those. So if you are a trainer and you want to get into this tactical world of coaching and getting paid to coach tactical athletes, definitely check out the NSCA with their, you know, tactical strength and conditioning program. But yeah, get the CSCS too, because it's just a put it this way. I bet you when you become a physician's assistant, you will still put CSCS along your, you know, Tyler, Coke, MS, you know, doctor, you know, physician's assistant, CSCS, because it means a lot. It means a lot in the fitness world. It's, you know, I think I read that there's millions, like 2.5 million personal trainers in America, but like 25,000 CSCSs.
Interesting. It makes sense. It's a hard certification. It's one that at this point is required to work with really any level of, you know, elite athlete, however you want to categorize that. So yeah, an important certification, one I keep up every year and one proud to have, you know, next to my name, those initials.
Yep, absolutely. Well, tell me this, how was the job hunt to become a tactical fitness strength and conditioning coach? Because that, you know, there's so many different ways to do it, but I'm just curious in how you became employed by the Air Force working with pilots.
Yeah. Tactical had been a world that I wanted to get into for a long time. And it was always my route versus wanting to go more D1 or more professional sort of classic strength conditioning with the sports environment. So I actually tried to get into the tactical world for 4 or 5 years before I actually got into it. I started applying when I was running the CrossFit affiliate, applied as I was getting out of grad school. So it took a long time for me to get in. The route for me personally was I actually worked in corporate wellness for about a year and a half. And then I was hired by a company for the Air Force. And just as luck would have it, they liked people who worked in corporate wellness because you have to manage contracts in corporate wellness. Is you have your client, you have the company that you work for, and you have to manage that. And you have to hit revenue goals, things along those lines. And so the company that hired me really liked that because the Air Force and the military in general is not dissimilar from having to manage contracts. And every, you know, you're in some ways, you are there to be a coach. In some ways, it's a sales job too, because you have to, every year that contract comes up for renewal. Even if it doesn't come up for renewal, something about contracting in the military is that there's a lot of money at the top end. You know, there's this huge budget, but at the end of like people like me, it's a trickle, and it can be very hard to get money sometimes. And so your ability to go in there and be, you know, successful and have people want to say like, yeah, we want to give these people money in this contract money because it's really important. So that helped as far as getting me into the world itself. But as far as, you know, you'd mentioned before some of those different avenues, like I have a friend of mine who spent time helping build the Army's new fitness test. And so he got into the military much more of a classical route as he spent time with sort of Division I athletes and then made the transition over there. Some of my colleagues did the same thing. There's a lot of different avenues to get in. I think some of the similarities that overlap all those avenues is one, just general experience. And it's experience working with a lot of different types of populations, I think. There's a feeling sometimes among strength and conditioning coaches that if you haven't worked with an elite population, that you're not as good of a coach as someone who is. And certainly to work with an elite population requires a specific skill set. But the, you know, the best time for me as a coach when I learned the most, I worked at this private performance facility in Columbus, Ohio. And I was training a professional MMA athlete, power lifter, Olympic lifter, some D1 football players, some high school volleyball girls who were going, I think, D2. And as well as just training general population people who wanted to be healthy. And it's experiences like that that have really helped translate to the military, because you're forced to identify what you stand for as a coach and what you are as a coach, because your MMA fighter and your Olympic lifter, very different adaptation, different mindset. And then, you know, after that, you have a mom and a dad coming in who just want to be healthy for their kids. So what is your coaching style that's able to permeate all of that? And then what's your programming methodology as well, that you can take what you do really well and apply it to these different avenues? And that was a commonality for me among a lot of the tactical coaches that I've worked with, and especially the very good ones, is they have that breadth and that ability to relate to a lot of different types of populations, a lot of different methodologies. So as far as getting in, I think there's a lot of different avenues to get into that world. Mine was much less common with corporate wellness. You'll see more of, you know, classically sports, but the commonality is among having this really broad experience seems to be really important as well.
Do you recall some of the corporations that contracted trainers? I mean, I've seen a couple over
for tactical.
Yeah, for tactical.
Yeah, so I've worked for a company called T3I, was my first job in the military. Duro has been with the fighter pilots in Vermont. There's LMR is one. I think Gap Solutions is one. I could come up with a few more with time, but there's several out there. Bering Straits would be one as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I just want to put a little out there, and I'll put a list of them in the description of this video. Great. So if you're interested in, you know, trying to become a contracted coach and trainer, just read the list and, you know, happy hunting.
Yeah. And just as a last point on that, the Army, because they have the holistic health and fitness, the H2F contract recently, within the last few years, they're at this point kind of begging people to join and to be coaches. So it's a really good time, especially as a young coach in the field, to make that break into the military. Now is a good time if you're willing to move, you know, all these Army bases all over the country. Yeah. It's a good time to get in.
Oh, cool. So let's talk a little about, you've had, you know, coaching experience with the mom and dad, the athlete, the tactical athlete. How would you define really those three different categories of fitness? Like, how would you differentiate tactical fitness from athletic fitness?
I think the commonality, as we talked about before, is adaptation. You're trying to adapt them specifically. The differences have to do between sports and tactical. Your demand set is how I think about it. So your demand set is a lot different. The demand set is the activity itself. So tactically, and even within tactical, which I'm sure we'll get into, fighter pilots versus SEALs, to make a very distinct distinction. But within sports, you're, you know, like a baseball player and a fighter pilot, as an example, very distinct demand sets. And one of the big ones is your seasons. You have in season, out of season when it comes to sports, which is very delineated, and you know it's going to happen. There's never a variability for your in season, and there's never a variability for your out season. Whereas with the tactical athletes, there's a ton of variability. And I tend to think about it more as phases as opposed to seasons with tactical athletes. Because, like, at least for the pilots, which I can speak to, they have this big cycle of flying that they go through. And it depends on the airframe, how long that is. And then that's broken up into these different phases. And some of those phases are high G, some of those are less high G, some of those are sitting in the jet for a longer period of time. Some of them are at night, some of them are early in the morning. And so that variability, to use a single word, is such a big difference, I think, between the sport community and the tactical community.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just the fact that many of the folks that you work with are working nights and not sleeping regularly.
Yeah.
You know, so what are some of your go-tos when you see somebody burning the candle at both ends, right? With just life, work, and now they're coming into the gym and they're expecting you to, like, lay it on them.
Yeah.
what are some of your go-tos for that athlete? Cause I have to personally, and it's really hard for athletes to hear this is when I pull the reins on them and say, "Woo, let's take it easy." It's not something they enjoy doing.
Completely. Yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from on that. And I think that's, so I, as I've gotten to the, like, you know, I'm not old at all, but like the later stages of my career, I tend to think more of what I do is that I'm a human performance coach as opposed to a strength coach. And I don't see that as semantic, and I'll tell you why. Because I think human performance, or I think strength and conditioning rather, is very much like we're seeking these specific adaptations as far as like strength or speed or hypertrophy. It's somewhat of a narrow focus. Not that it's right. not hard to do, because it's very hard to do, but it's more of a narrow focus. Whereas I feel like what I do now, I encompass much more of the musculoskeletal continuum. So for an example, if someone is coming off like an injury, they need rehabilitation. I spend a lot more time in rehab at this point than I did when I was more in my strength and conditioning classically. So I spend time in rehab. I'll spend time in keeping people healthy. I'll spend time in sort of building resilience so they're less likely to get hurt. And then also in performance. So it's a much broader scope as opposed to just these specific like performance adaptations. It's bigger than that. So within that mindset, and I've had this example before, and it's a really good one. With the people that I coach, and especially with the pilots that I've worked with, one of the rules for the programming for me, because I write my programming in 4-week cycles, and we'll build towards certain things, and the cycles will change depending on the phase of flying that they're in, which we can get into, but it's a 4-week cycle. And they all know that everything that is written down in their program is subject to change. So there are certain days they'll come in, I'll just cross out a movement. Like, I don't like you doing this today because you're not moving that well. And because of this mindset of human performance as opposed to strength and conditioning, and I've done this before, just like you said, I had a guy show up, he's going through an upgrade. This happened with several people. They're going through an upgrade, so it's a very busy time for them. They're flying a lot of high Gs. They're not sleeping well. Maybe they have a kid at home too, who's like 4 or 5 months old, so just a lot going on. They'll come in the gym for the day. I'll say, "Hey, how you feeling?" "Oh, feeling good, ready to get going." And I'll look at them breathe, and they're breathing through their chest, and they're warming up, and they're much tighter than normal, and they're more sore than they used to be. Some of these indicators that you can use.
Great.
And so I say, "All right, I want you to lay on your back, and I want you to pop up your feet like on a Swiss ball or on a bench. And I want you to put your hands on your belly, and I want 60 deep belly breaths." That's what I'll tell them. Like, we're going to start here. It's just going to relax your body, and then we'll go. And what happens is they fall asleep every time. But that's my goal. You know, like that's why the field of human performance and the mindset there for me was an important transition, because my job is to take care of their bodies. Like, that's ultimately what I'm trying to do, is to take care of their physical health and well-being. And what that person needs on that day is not a workout. What that person needs on that day is sleep. And that's my job. That's my domain. So I've done that with people, and I partner within my role with the fighter pilots with an athletic trainer, and she's amazing. Just so much knowledge. She's great with the pilots, built this great culture. And she's had the same thing on her table. She's treating someone, they fall asleep, she'll walk out of the room, dim the lights. But that's, I do think that that's an important part of the role, is we are not right. The stress response is an important part of understanding what we're doing. And sometimes what you need is just rest. And so that's happened quite a bit.
No, I love that. I mean, our number one and number two recovery methods is sleep and nutrition. 100%. You know, and I always tell people, like, everybody asks me about, what about ice baths? What about saunas? What about, you know, what about all these different tools that you can use, massage guns, right, for recovery? I'm like, if you can eat and sleep well, you got 90% of your recovery taken care of, if not
100%. I totally agree with you.
So, yeah, that is so important. How about working with pilots compared to, I guess other tactical athletes or athletes in general?
Sure.
What are some of their needs that they need to focus on?
Yeah. So the big one is the G's, as you had mentioned before, and, the G's are really challenging, right? The force of gravity that is brought on by the jet itself, and the speed and the turning and everything else. That's really challenging, because as opposed to almost every other athletic endeavor, tactical or otherwise, we can somewhat understand how your body is going to respond without you playing the sport itself. So if we use something like soccer as a really easy example, I can take you out to the pitch. We can run, we can cut, we can jump, you can kick a soccer ball, but you can't do that with the jet. Like, I can't just put you in a jet and or a centrifuge and spin you around a little bit. And like, how are you going to do? So it's hard to train for that because it's your time is so limited in that demand set itself. So that's definitely one of the big challenges. And I'll address after this, like, kind of how we do that. But one of the big challenges, the other one I think too, that is different and very unique, is that the pilots do all of their activities seated. Everything is seated. And so that's a very important part of training pilots, is that they're not doing this standing. They're not doing this crawling. Like SEALs, totally different, right? The amount of time you guys spend like just seated, like you would in a cockpit, very small, where crawling, standing, running, jumping, doing that with weight on your back, shooting at the same time, managing your heart rate, right? We see some overlap in that, but they're very distinct as far as training fighter pilots. Good point. The G's and the sitting piece of that are very important to understand. And then that leads to inevitably understanding, you know, where do these pilots get injured because of those specific demand sets? And then how do you build resilience to improve, you know, performance for them? So as far as injuries for pilots, because of the G's that they have, they can build up and then be variable. So if you have a high G sortie, you're 7, 8, 9 G's for, you know, several rounds as you're going through dogfighting. And they're doing that in a seated position. And usually they're doing that not just seated upright like we are now, but they're going to be flexed forward, rotated, and looked up like this, right? And that depends on the airframe itself. Like an F-16 would be a little bit different, but the F-35, the ergonomics of the seat are not ideal for that. So yeah, I mean, just sitting there like that in general with no load on you is not ideal, and you're going to have some spine issues. But they do that under, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 G's.
Woo.
And so classically, fighter pilots in my population had this, a lot of spine issues is what you see. And it depends on the jet, again, depends on the airframe, but you're typically going to see lumbar issues and cervical issues. We had more cervical for our population. And yeah, the real challenge with that is, and this is true of, you know, any tactical and any elite individual, is that you're in a population with 100% injury rate. Everybody gets hurt at some point. And so you have to take that into account too, especially in this population here, where they're pulling G's, they're doing so from a bad position. And unfortunately, anatomically, if you look at the cervical spine, you just don't have a lot of support structures there. Where if you look at the, you know, the thoracic spine and the lower back, you have a lot of this musculature, you have the thoracolumbar fascia, which does a really good job of supporting those areas and can take a lot of force. But your cervical spine can't. And part of that reason is because you have a lot of motion with your cervical spine. And there's a kind of a general rule, probably in physiology, but definitely the musculoskeletal system, that the more function that a part has, the higher the likelihood that something goes wrong. And your shoulder is a good example of this, right? Your shoulder has this wonderful range of motion, but what's the trade-off for the range of motion? A ton of rotator cuff injuries, whereas you don't see the same type of thing in your hip. Right? Because your hip has less range of motion.
Sure.
So your cervical spine, uniquely compared to your thoracic and your lumbar spine, has much more range of motion because of the specifics of the facet joint and sort of how that works in your spine. So all of that to say, to bring it back, is we're in a demand set with fighter pilots where they're not in a good position. The musculature supporting that part of your body, your neck, in a bad position isn't as robust as we would like it to be. And then they're doing this, you know, in the high G phase of their flying, they're doing this consecutively for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks in a row. So you're just getting hit over and over and over again, not unlike, you know, to more of a classical sport like football in season. It's sort of the understanding even from a fan is like, they're just getting beat up every week. They're getting beat up and every week they're getting beat up. So it's hard for those injuries to heal. And so we deal with something very similar when it comes to the spine during high G phases, because it just, you just get beat up and you're, again, you're in an activity with 100% injury rate. So taking that into account is going to be really important. So bringing that back to, they do that in the seated position. Something that we do a lot for training is I do a lot of work, much more so than I would do with any other population, of building strength in the seated position. We press, we pull. I'll have them do seated holds. Actually, my favorite exercise for the pilots is called a Z sit, where you're on the ground, your legs are out in front of you, and your torso is nice and tall like this. And the legs can be bent, but the idea is you're sitting on the ground with an erect spine, so you're nice and tall.
Okay.
And I'll have guys, one of my standards is to take half your body weight. So if you're 200 pounds, you take 100 pounds, you hold it in a gobble position, and I have them hold it there for about 2 minutes.
Nice.
Is one of my initial standards. And we build up to that, but we do a lot of work. We press from that position. We pull from that position. We hold there. We do a lot of carries, but the seated position is, I think, really important to the maintenance of a fighter pilot because they spend so much time there. You need to train that specific adaptation that you're trying to seek to help them in the jet. Whereas with like a Navy SEAL, if I were to train you in the seated position, that'd be a terrible adaptation, right?
Right.
We wouldn't want to do that. We want to do something else. So I think each of these different worlds has unique abilities and a unique ability to train them for the adaptation. But with fighter pilots specifically, the neck challenges that we see doing so in a seated position are probably two of the most unique demand sets probably known to man.
I would agree. In fact, it sounds like, your definition of core is an entire system from your hips to the base of your skull.
Completely.
And everything in between. So there's not 100%. Just like doing crunches going to work your core. You got to work everything in between in multiple directions and planes. And
it's a great point. And we do that a lot. Is it's not just exactly to your point. Yes, we do the Z sit where it's static and you're building strength and building capacity. But another reality I think you have to face if you're working with any sort of tactical population is, right, so we talked about that position for the fighter pilots looking over their shoulder to pull Gs. If I know, so this is what I think about as a coach, like if I know that that's their position where they're flexed forward and they're rotated, and being flexed and rotated in your spine is classically the worst thing that you want to do, right? Like that's when people herniate a disc.
Sure.
But that's the position my pilots are in on a semi-consistent basis. So then the question is, do I want to train that position because I know they're going to be in that position? So do I want to build resilience in a bad position, or do I want to make sure that I can build resilience in good positions, hoping that when they get out of those good positions, that they have the ability to withstand that? I don't have a great answer for you on that. I'd be curious what you think with your experience, because I know like SEALs have their own sort of bad positions, if you will.
Oh, sure.
But at least for me, my approach for something like that is to say, kind of like sports, like we want to train athletes to be mobile, strong, fast, et cetera. And then we know when the activity comes in a sport, they're out of that pristine, perfect pattern that we're looking for. But because we've trained them well, we have a translation, right? You get this translation of a training effect. So that's been my approach. So all of that to say, I do a lot of work in good positions, but first step is we get them mobile through their spine in the proper range of motion. And this includes not just rotation, but lateral bending, flexion, extension, right? All these different motions that your spine can make. We get range of motion, all of those. And then from there, we build capacity as far as strength in those ranges of motion. So I'll have my pilot Z sit and then rotate like this and then hold that position. I'll have them right laterally flex or bend over and hold weight in that position for a while too. And then my goal is that given enough time to build resilience and all that musculature of the spine and then the core, to your point, kind of the whole system, that when they get in the jet and they're in this really bad position, my hope, and we saw this through the data, so it seemed to work, but that my hope is because we built resiliency in safe positions, a lot of positions, but still safe positions, that it then translates really well to these bad positions in the jet. But I'd be curious what you think about that too with what you've done.
No, absolutely. That is an extremely logical process, what you're doing. And, something that I would consider, if I were training pilots is the process they go through to fight G's. Mm-hmm. And what does that look like? And how can I make that better for them? Because they're grunting, they're straining, they're flexing, sounds like they're pooping or peeing. I mean, they're just straining to get everything in there real tight. So it'd be real interesting. Like, what do you kind of can you brace, you know, teach them to brace, you know, like they're doing deadlifts or squats? Is that bracing technique very helpful for the pilot?
Yeah.
They are going through G's and things.
Yeah. The research basically, so there's not a lot of research on fighter pilots, unfortunately, not a lot of research tactical, you know, in the tactical world in general, which is really unfortunate. But yeah, there is basic research that shows that the stronger you get, there's a limit on this, but it's not really important for this conversation, is if you get stronger in a deadlift and a squat, your G straining gets better. And we've done specific focus on the G strain itself too. And again, this would depend airframe to airframe, because the F-35 sort of, they call it bleeding energy, so it doesn't hold G's for a long period of time. Whereas these airframes with kind of bigger wings and two engines would be better at sustaining G's. So you have to G strain for longer. But what we'll do is we'll do something called an isometric mid-thigh pull. So it's basically just doing a deadlift where the bar is at your knees, but the bar is not going to move. So you're moving against kind of a really heavy bar or a pin pull, that type of thing. There's a lot of ways to set this up.
Yep.
And what I'll have them do is I'll have them pull like that and, you know, 50, 60, 70%, whatever they're comfortable with, and then work on that G strain maneuver as well. So we get the adaptation of, you know, the muscles of the lower body are firing, which is occluding blood flow, which is what they want, to keep blood up.
Right.
And then from there, they're able to work on their breathing at the same time. So I've experimented around with a few different exercises like that. That would be one. Another one I've tried in the past, which, you know, I'm like 50-50 on, is I'll have them sit on a bench and they'll take a band. So a band is tied to like a column in front of them on a rack, and they'll pull the band over around their body and kind of cinch it around their waist. So the band is pulling them towards the column, and then they'll sit there and they'll hold. So because the band is pulling them, they have to strain with their lower body to keep themselves in place. And then we work on breathing in that position. So what we try to do is take, just as you said, we try to take these general concepts of what we know. Hey, we have to breathe while we're straining and work on this specific technique. We know that strength is correlated with this. And so then we can experiment and be creative with how we're designing these exercises for the person, but also for the population, to be able to achieve the desired outcome that we're looking for.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that's really cool. Earlier we were talking about phases of your training, you know, pilots going through phases, and I have kind of described tactical fitness in a similar way, because, you know, like, as you said, the tactical athlete does not have an off season. I mean, they may go on leave for a week,
sure,
whatever, you know, but typically they don't have an off season. Yes, they may not be deploying this cycle, but they're working up for the next deployment, which can be just as bad or worse than the actual deployment.
Yeah.
So you're working all the time. So I've kind of broken it up into three phases, where you have phase one, and this is your journey phases, not necessarily the pilot's phase.
Mm-hmm.
So phase one is you have to train specifically for a fitness test that allows you to gain access to this community, right? Whether it's a ACFT or a PST in the Navy, whatever, there's a fitness standard that you have to meet. Otherwise, you're not going to get this job. And you get the opportunity to go to the next phase, which is phase two, the selection or the boot camp or the academy or whatever. You know, you have to train specifically for the challenges of that phase, you know, whether it's BUDS or EOD school or something like that. You know,
sure.
You got specifics. And then phase three is really where all the money is spent, where you are working in this phase three for the active duty operator. And you're right, it completely changes. You're not going to be doing many phase one, phase two workouts when you're a phase three operator.
Sure.
Right. You're focused more on human performance.
Yeah.
Mitigation of stress, flexibility and flexibility, mobility to gain longevity, right? But it's something that's pretty rare to see an old man or old woman doing these jobs, right?
Sure.
You are going to be older longer than you are younger if you make it a career.
Yeah.
So longevity has to be really fixated, you know, by by the tactical athlete, you know, to focus on human performance in the big picture, not doing the old butt kicking workouts you did preparing for selection. Right. Mm-hmm. That's over. That chapter's over. Sure. Now you can always go back to phase one because there's something new you want to do. You want to go to a spec ops unit while you're an active duty military guy. Mm-hmm. You got to go back to phase one and prepare for that test. Be competitive on that fitness test. And then you have to prepare for the next selection that you're going through. So there is a journey that occurs for the tactical athlete that has this phase one, phase two, phase three concept. But really it comes down to specificity, being specific with where you are, what you're trying to do. Make your weaknesses less of a weakness. Yeah. Because you know, when you go through these type of training programs, your weaknesses will be exposed mm-hmm. really quickly, right? Yeah. And if you have an underdeveloped weakness, it's going to require a new level of mental toughness mm-hmm. that is going to be have to be done every day just to get through that event, if you get through the event and meet the standard.
Sure.
So that has been kind of my journey in definition of tactical fitness. Yeah. I kind of play around in the phase one, phase two world.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my thoughts. I'm just curious what you think of that.
Yeah, I love that. It's a really interesting perspective. It's not one that I have thought a lot about with the pilot community. Though one of the reasons is because I think, you know, the standard of fitness that you need to be a SEAL and the standard of fitness you need to be a pilot are objectively different. You know what I mean? It's not to say that pilots aren't fit. Some of them are, but it is obviously different. What's really interesting in that, though, is that my first job with the Air Force was within undergraduate pilot training, which is the first step in the pipeline to be any sort of pilot. So fighter pilots go through there. If you want to fly something mobility like a C-5 or a C-17 is an example, you would go through that as well. So everyone starts within UPT and then they differentiate from there. And historically, the Air Force had no human performance within UPT until, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And so I was lucky enough to be part of a team that included strength and conditioning coaches, cognitive performance coaches, nutritionists, who went into Vance Air Force Base within UPT and built the first human performance initiative that the Air Force had ever seen, and was going to use that as a model to then apply it to these other UPT bases as well. So in thinking about your phases there, what the Air Force was trying to do, which I think, you know, SEALs and equivalents have done a better job of, is trying to say, hey, we know you're a pilot. We know that there's physical requirements that you need. And so we want to start preparing you as early as we can so that when you show up with people like me in a squadron, you have a baseline level of deadlift or back squat or whatever these metrics are that you're looking for. And even this just basic movement, you know, would be good too. Like, how do I use my body is a part of the skill set that we try and teach. It's not just the lifting. It's how do you use your body? How does your body recover? What's your stress like? Do you understand that response within yourself? So the Air Force is trying to do that, you know, kind of more phase two, I think, for your paradigm, which I think is incredibly useful and incredibly important. And obviously needed, because what they're trying to do with fighter pilots now is they're trying to say, hey, we want to start this within UPT. So step one, so you join the Air Force, you're going to be a pilot. Here's your human performance in step one. Step two for fighter pilots is called B course, where you get into your jet that you're going to fly for your career, at least the first part of your career. So you're in B course for a year, year and a half. You have human performance there, and then you show up with someone like me and you have human performance there. So they're trying to make it much more continuous, which I think is really good because, you know, as again, to your paradigm there, what had happened before in the Air Force would be the equivalent of, in a sport like football, you have no strength and conditioning in high school, you have no strength and conditioning in college, and you show up to the NFL and it's like, oh, you're supposed to lift. Obviously, that doesn't make any sense, right? And so the Air Force is trying to adopt that mentality, which I think is great. And I think jives really well with what you were thinking about too, because you're able just to, I think you keep people around for longer is ultimately what it comes down to, you know, because it's 100% injury rate. You can build resilience from a younger age. You can keep that resilience for longer. You can keep people in for longer. You know, elite people in the military, you know, to be practical, are very expensive. They're expensive to train. and you're expensive to keep around. Like you're a multi-million dollar asset for the government. So you're a multi-million dollar athlete in the same framework as sports, and you want to keep your multi-million dollar athletes around as long as possible. And so how do you do that? And this is one of the ways that we do that.
I love that. So let's talk a little bit about future Tyler, right? Mm-hmm. So what are you trying to do? Like you've worked your way up from CrossFit affiliate to master's degree, head strength and conditioning, human performance directors, with the Air Force. Now with this next journey being, physician assistant, where do you see things moving in the next 5 years for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. So a lot of it comes down to a framework that I have for the musculoskeletal system, which is that the human body, the musculoskeletal system, operates on this continuum. And the continuum is injury, rehabilitation, health, resilience, and performance. So injury is obviously, is very obvious. Actually, you're hurt, you're injured, and that can require surgery. It can require typically like an orthopedic practitioner to help you heal. And then after you're out of injury, you're then in rehabilitation. You have to recover. And then once you've recovered and sort of the tissue, the muscle, whatever is being hurt is back to baseline, you're in health. Resilience is the next stage, and that's the process of making you less likely to get hurt. So that can be in a tactical setting. That can be for a mom and dad. That can be for someone like you and me at this point who don't use our bodies for a living. We just want to be healthy and age and feel good. So you have that resilience piece. And then you have performance, which is, again, classically more strength and conditioning. And performance, is this really rare space where you get to organize your life around a specific outcome. And true performance is incredibly rare. Like, I know you've gone through something like that as an individual, but real, genuine performance is not something to be undertaken lightly. It's an all-out assault on, I'm going to do everything I can to achieve this goal. So all of that to say, there's this continuum within the musculoskeletal system. And as I spent more time in this field, I started out in sort of resilience and performance, which is classically the realm of strength and conditioning. And then as I expanded a little bit and entered some of these bigger roles, I spent more time in rehabilitation and health and sort of helping people get back to where they were before. Spent time, again, I partner with an athletic trainer who's taught me so much about this rehab and health phase that she's excellent at. And so I feel like, me personally, having gone through this transition of like, okay, I feel like I understand one side of this continuum, but I don't really understand injury that well, right? I don't have an orthopedic skill set where if you were to come in with a dislocated shoulder, I wouldn't know how to fix it. And if you come with a broken bone, I wouldn't know how to reduce it. And so that's something I want to understand. But the reason for that is because I don't feel like that there's a practitioner out there who has a really good understanding of the whole continuum, right? Doctors very classically are injury, human performance again spans the other side of this continuum. PTs are typically just rehabilitation, right? Within this paradigm, in this model, you can kind of see how we have these different people for these different roles. I think one of the challenges with that though, is that your care gets divided up so much that it can be really challenging to actually recover, right? If you get hip replacement surgery or knee replacement surgery, or if you're someone who's younger, and you're dealing with a rotator cuff tear and you're trying to come back to that, you're typically, as an average individual, you're going to see a lot of different people. You're going to see the doctor or the PA. They're going to do surgery on you. They're going to send you to rehab. And then rehab's going to finish with you because of insurance. And then you're going to move on to someone else. You sign up for a personal trainer. So you have all these people overseeing your care. And I think the challenge is that a lot of people live with some deficit to their musculoskeletal function as they age. This is like everybody. And I think in a lot of ways, age is synonymous with that. Age is synonymous with how much deficit do you have to your system, right? If you're 90 and you have the body of a 20-year-old, you're not that old. If you're 20 and you have the body of a 9-year-old, you're old, right? And so that's like an easy thought, but what I want to try and do as a practitioner is be someone who understands all of that. And the goal is to open up a clinic. And as part of an orthopedic clinic, the main focus of our clinic is not injury. The main focus of our clinic is a gym. So you would be a part of the clinic and you have a gym. So we are trying to be on the proactive side, whereas normally in orthopedics, you show up because you have a broken bone or because your shoulder hurts or because your knee hurts. What we want to do is say, we want to be a clinic where you're going to show up because you're healthy and you're showing up because we're keeping you healthy. So I want to bring people that I know from this world, strength and conditioning coaches, human performance coaches, and sort of build this team where we can be holistic about taking care of people with the perfect world of saying like, hey, you're a part of this clinic. You've been here for 10 or 15 years and you've never had an injury. That's the goal of the clinic, as opposed to we just have injured people walking through our door.
No, I love that. That is really genius, to be honest with you. I will tell you, I like my doctor, but my doctor is a biker, right? He just bikes. And if you know bikers, that's all they do. they just bike and then they'll tell you about it. And, you know, so he's very lean. So when he looks at the BMI chart, right, he is within the BMI standards of healthy. I am labeled obese by him. And I said, Doc, I lift weights all the time. Yeah, I got like 13% body fat. You know, I used to have less when I was younger, but I'm not. I'm not in this dangerous position. You know, he keeps telling me I got to lose like 30 pounds. And I'm like, Doc, you know, I wasn't 170 pounds since ninth grade.
Sure.
So anyway, you're right. You know, even doctors, you know, don't thoroughly understand the fitness and the nutrition and the elements of training in general. That'd be really neat. You know, something, if you grow really well and you're looking for PAs that get it, there's a massive number of folks that are like former spec ops corpsmen that become PAs. You know, I count on, you know, just off the top of my head, over a dozen that I know that have gone on to become PAs, and some of them have gone on to become doctors.
Sure.
But those spec ops medics are a special breed that definitely understand the big picture like that. So if you need future PAs that understand, I hope you grow to a point where you need a dozen of them. So
I would love that.
They are out there. I wish you all the success in the world. I really do appreciate this. I love talking to people smarter than me. And I really enjoy hearing your journey and, you know, the similarities that I think many trainers have as they go on. You just kept on going and aren't stopping. So kudos to you, because that's a hard journey. I remember looking at when I got out of the military, I considered going to medical school. And I considered it for like a month. And then I started looking into like, okay, I got to study for the MCATs. Okay. Oh, by the way, I need to take another set of courses just to get my base courses down. And I was like, wow, okay, this is going to be a little longer than I thought. So that was my med school experience.
Yeah, no, I get that. I've gone through PA school. Is certainly not medical school at all. There are still requirements that you need to, you know, apply and get in, et cetera. And, you know, I'll share this with you. I think one of the reasons that I've been able to make this transition. So I'm 33, I'll be 34 when school starts. So 36 when we graduate. So it is, you know, I went to grad school the first time when I was 25. So it is a long, you know, it is to your point, it's a long process and a lot of effort to put in. But I think something that has become very clear to me after working with, you know, the military and, you know, your community is that what I love about that is there's always continuous growth. Like with the fighter pilots as an example, because I know them really well, but I know this translates certainly. But the fighter pilots, you know, they go through all this training. It's, you know, 2 to 3 year process just to get in your jet and show up to a squadron. And then from there, you know, you go through upgrades. And so these upgrades can be 6 months long and you're learning. So you're being a flight lead, then you're an instructor. And then, you know, you have weapons school for the Air Force, Top Gun for the Navy, Marine has their own as well. Yep. But there's all these progressions kind of built in, and you get to see that with these individuals who are in their, you know, mid 30s, late 30s, still progressing, still growing, and moving to squadron commander, moving to the OG, whatever it is. And, you know, one of the great things that I really don't think this is appreciated enough about the military, having spent time with you guys, is that the caliber of person in the military at this level is incredibly high. Like, you're all very smart. You're all very driven. You all work really well as a team. You're all really good examples of like what it means to be a confident, competent man, which I think was important for me to be around that. And so making this transition to go back to school again, while a lot of effort, I don't want to put too much on it. I mean, it's a couple of years, so it's not bad, but it's the example was laid out before me by your community of all these people working really hard and being really successful. Like, there's a pilot who's going to Columbia for a master's degree in engineering. Nice. Another guy came from Wall Street, you know, just like very, very successful people who are ambitious into their 30s and into their 40s. And having that as a role model, you know, those people in your community has been really instrumental in wanting to take this next step forward.
Yeah, I would agree. I think always being okay with being the new guy and the student is a trait that will take you very far.
Yeah.
You know, so I congratulate you on your challenge to get through the 20th grade, you know, whatever, how many years, you know, school you go through, 12 plus four in college, plus a couple of masters. Yeah. You're almost going to be on 20th grade here in a minute.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I found you on LinkedIn. I think you reached out to me briefly. Is there anything else you would like to discuss? Maybe where people can find out more about Tyler Koch?
Yeah, I actually don't have any sort of information out there right now. Just been kind of head down trying to improve the craft. I can give you my email address after this, and you're welcome to put it in the show notes. And if people have any questions, they're more than welcome to reach out. I'd be happy to help.
That's cool. Well, I do appreciate it. You know, as I said earlier, there are a lot of people that are trainers that are looking to get into that tactical realm. And
sure,
you know, you've kind of paved the way with, you know, your history. So I really do appreciate you sharing that information.
Of course. Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful. I've listened to you, like I said, when I emailed you, I've listened to you for a long time and I've learned a lot from you, just methodology. Again, you talk to your phases, everything else. So I really appreciate having this conversation.
Well, I appreciate you because I feel smarter after 57 minutes of communication. So
great.
All right. Until next time, folks, this is Stu Smith and Tyler Koch with the Tactical Fitness Report.